So I'm sort of a late fill-in speaker. Misha Lukin was going to come, but he's been sort of exhausted with a lot of his travel. So what I'm going to do is, and this is also sort of not a great time for us to give a talk on the collaborative work we've been doing, because we're in the middle of several projects. But that's what I'm going to tell you about, really, some of the stuff we've done that most of you know about. So we'll go through that kind of rapidly. And then tease you with little bits of projects that are sort of just starting or in the middle. And you have to take it all with a grain of salt, because we're not sure about any of the results yet, and et cetera. So really, this is just an update on the collaborative work that we're doing at Harvard, experimental work that we're doing at Harvard in this sort of stored light activity. I don't have great opinions about the use of these various phrases, storing, stopping, freezing, et cetera. I think they're all just sort of poetic license, as long as we all agree that, you know, we can give names to things and we agree on what the physics is underneath, then I don't really care. But that's sort of what we started calling it from the beginning, just because some of the motivation was driven by the desire to do quantum information processing, et cetera. So what I'm going to tell you about is some of the, since certainly for me, I'm not a quantum optics person. This is very, I've really done two experiments and now we're starting other ones. That's my entire experience in the field. And I'm new to this. Misha's been working in it longer than that, of course, but primarily theoretically. I'm going to tell you a little bit of the context of who we are and what we're doing, where we are, et cetera. I'll review through the two published works that we have to date, these stored light demonstrations in warm vapor cells of rubidium, where we show that the basic idea at least sort of semi-quantitatively works using strong, relatively strong, let's call them classical light pulses, and how we demonstrated, as you would expect, that it is that is a phase coherent process, and that you can control the phase, et cetera, and write that back down to the light that's emitted at the end. Now I'll talk about the experiments that we're planning to perform to test, let's call it the canonical stored light theory, and to optimize the technique. It's far from optimized, that's for sure. Outline our sort of our major activity right now, which is this plan to demonstrate this stored light technique at the single quantum level. Tell you a little bit about these recent measurements that we're doing of the statistics of Raman light. That's one of these things that's very much in process and not a finished piece of work. I come mostly from a precision measurements atomic clock background, and I was going to tell you maybe a little bit about our CPT, coherent population trapping clock work, but given how I feel, let's forget about that. And then I'll tell you along the way, not just at the end, sort of the papers that I've been reading in particular. Most of them have either this guy's name on them, Michael, or Misha's name on them, but not all of them, that we're using to inspire and influence the work that we're doing. Okay. Whew. I've also pumped myself full of drugs, and so it kind of gives you this woozy feeling. All right, so there's two groups. There's my group at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, which we're an experimental atomic physics group. Atomic clocks and precision fundamental symmetry tests is one of the main things that we do. We also have a large activity using NMR to do biomedical imaging, biophysics, and soft matter, granular media, porous media, this sort of thing. Some of the clock work in the last couple of years has involved rubidium and these CPT clocks. And so from that, we've gotten involved in this field, this stored light field, mainly through the interactions with Michael Fleischauer and Mikhail Lukin. Now, Misha is now, after leaving ITAMP, and he was at the CFA for a couple of years as a postdoc, has now moved into the down the street to the Department of Physics at Harvard, where he's an assistant professor. And he's primarily doing theory, but we also have a separate lab set up over there. And there's a collaborative experimental work going on in the physics department as well as up at the CFA. And he has a variety of things going on, and what I'm going to tell you about is our collaborative experimental work. So the people who are currently working on, and recently we're also working on, this collaborative experimental work are given here. Myself, I'm a federal scientist with the Smithsonian and an adjunct at Harvard. Misha is an assistant professor in the physics department. David Phillips, who's a staff scientist at the Smithsonian. Sasha Zebroff, who some of you know, who's now moved into being a senior visiting scientist at the Smithsonian. Very capable postdoc, Casper Van der Waal, and then a sort of a horde of relatively young graduate students, a few doing some experiments, some doing some theory too. And also some a former postdoc and Michael's wife, Annette, who has actually worked in the lab and very key in some of the first experiments that we did. They have contributed greatly. My view of the timeline. The theory was done by Michael and Misha and Suzanne Yellen in the sort of 99-2000 period. The idea for us doing these experiments just came about from sitting around and talking physics at ITAMP, that we, as we do often, which is this atomic physics theoretical institute at the CFA. And I realized that we had the equipment, or most of the equipment, to be able to realize these ideas. They're pretty simple to realize in the first experiments. Nevertheless, not having a lot of experience doing this type of work, it still took us several months to do it. By late in 2000, we had the experiments working. Lena Howe also was pursuing, with her cold atom setup, essentially the same basic scheme, and her experiment was working about the same time, and they were published right at the beginning of 2001. Then what we did in early 2001 ourselves in the lab was do this phase coherence control demo. Then we had to take this lab that we had been using at the CFA for this work, and we'd essentially been bootlegging the project off of money that the Navy had been giving us for clockwork, and for a year or more we'd not been doing clockwork. We had to return to the clockwork. And so there's been sort of a significant gap in time where we weren't doing anything at the CFA in the stored light area because we had to start doing the clockwork, and at the same time we were building up this new lab down at Harvard Physics. Sort of in late, maybe at the end of 2001 and then into 2002, we began this work, major work towards the single quantum storage project. And we're planning to build a new lab in a few months, an additional lab up at the CFA that will allow us to return back to doing a lot of sort of important, I think, nuts and bolts studies of the stored light process, verifying or testing the theoretical ideas, trying to optimize the technique, et cetera, and as well as pursue new ideas. The lab over at Physics is a quality laboratory, but it's very small. Sort of ironically, it's actually located right between Misha and Lena Howe's offices. They're right on two sides, and the lab's right in between. It's a little small room. So, okay. You all don't know this sort of thing very well, so I'm just going to skim very quickly through the work that we did in our first demonstrations. Obviously, what we'd like to do to take the group velocity of a pulse to zero is come up with a medium in which we can take the derivative of the index of refraction with frequency to infinity. And a clever way to be able to do that, of course, is to use, in a two-step process, this sort of thing, we call it dynamic EIT, where we take our, of course, conventional EIT setup with its well-known transparency window and strong variation of n with omega that has a strong positive slope there, and we are going to let the pulse go into the medium with the window open, and then once it's in the medium we will adiabatically close the transparency window, bringing the group velocity to zero, but also as the pulse slows it stays within that transparency window, and in principle you can do this with no losses, or minimal losses. Again, the advantages of EIT is that we have this very nicely controllable dispersion relation, as I've said here, and the strong interactions with, in principle, no one photon absorption. And because we're using, in our case, in our first experiments, Zeeman levels were the two ground levels, but you can also use different hyperphi levels. You can have very long coherence times. And as I'm sure you know quite well, also, the group velocity drops linearly with the control field laser power, the control field power, but the bandwidth has a similar dependency, and so they scale linearly with each other, group velocity and the bandwidth. So, as Michael described yesterday in his talk, the problem is to use EIT to bring the group velocity to zero, and as he described quite well, If you just try to set things up in a static configuration, at least with this sort of simple media, it doesn't work. Whereas if you use a dynamic EIT solution, you can make it work, where you have a two-step process. First, a spatial compression by typically 5 orders of magnitude, but no change to the temporal extent of the pulse or the bandwidth. And then you reduce the control beam to zero, and you have no change in the spatial profile in the simple case, but you have an infinite temporal expansion, i.e. it's brought to zero. Marlon is here. Now I can tease you, Marlon. Are you ready?
Ready.
You spoke yesterday, so we're sort of kicking along here. You spoke yesterday about your PhysRev letter, which took so long to get out. What was it, over a year, right? Well, sometimes the opposite happens. There was our paper. You can see it came out in January of 2001. It was submitted December of 2000. So that was approximately 1 month from submission to publication, which is about as... Yeah, I know. And of course, the reason was there was competition, and they were trying to ram the thing through the system, the competition with the Nature paper, you know, Howe's group there. And that just kind of shows you the reality of things. It's not so much the quality of the science, it's sort of the politics and everything.
Oh, it's the quality.
Okay. Quality of the refereeing, right? Yeah. Okay. So, continuing to whiz through this for you all who I'm sure understand it quite well. There's a cartoon scenario, signal pulse with the control field in. We create some sort of spin coherence due to the Raman scattering off the medium. There is this spatial compression, slow light propagation, control field off. Then the information or the differential information between the two beams has been mapped into the ground state coherence. Then you can turn the control field back on, Raman scatter off that coherence, reconstitute the pulse or a very close approximation of it, and out it comes. And as Michael said, the scheme that he and Misha developed to describe this is in terms of these dark state polaritons, where you find the eigenstates for this interaction terms in the Hamiltonian, and there is a mixing angle that determines the degree to which these eigenstates have a atomic component and a photonic component. And this is under your control experimentally by varying the control field intensity. And so that's one of the two initial papers that really described this. And there's more recent thorough work that they've done also, which goes into great detail. Kappa is, root kappa here is often what they call G root N, right? So it's the square root of the number of atoms times the coupling term, the dipole moment coupling term. It's a lot of nomenclature gets moved around. Are you consistent in the way you use those in your papers or not? Because I basically copy your nomenclature. So it's the strength of the coupling between the photons and the ensemble to the control field. Collective parameter, yeah. So, and this is very much the similar graph as was shown yesterday also, then the recipe is that you take the control field once the pulse is in the medium, and you bring it to zero, and then wait some time, and then can bring it back up to a strong value. So the polariton is always there, its shape is not varied, it's just that its position and propagation changes. But the mapping of the polariton back onto things that we people may care about for our own nefarious reasons, light, photons, or spin coherences, that can change in time. So if we want to send things in light for various reasons, then it's good to have it be in the photonic component. If we want to have it stored in atoms because we want to store, we want to process or compute or whatnot, then we can have it in a spin coherence. What is the velocity of the polariton? That's what I would say. My reaction would be it's just the group velocity. Yeah. The frint? I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. Oh.
Well, there's also, this ignores the atomic motion too. I mean, there is that going on, which is a form of decoherence, and as the atoms diffuse and move around, that's also going on, and we clearly see that in the experimental data, as I'll show you in a second. At least in the long time limit, that's the, it agrees reasonably well, that's what's going on, just simple diffusion out of the column where the light beam, control beam was and then will be, is the source of decoherence. I don't know if that's what you're asking about, but. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, and I'll tell you about our experiment now. I'm sort of whizzing through this sort of canonical idea.
For
now. Yeah, I mean, there are a variety of mechanisms. Sure, there's a variety of mechanisms. You can even have, yes, you can list out a variety of mechanisms. So, and they're all the sort of conventional ones that are well known. You crank up your alkali or whatever it is density, you can have spin exchange, of course. You can have diffusion. You can have collisions with the buffer gases. But in general, you can get relatively long times. I don't think that any of these systems, these vapor systems, are any sort of long-term storage medium. You know, you can dream of hundreds of milliseconds or seconds or something, but in coated cells, which we also make without buffer gases, we can get things which approach a second, although not quite a second. There you wouldn't be storing the pulse shape information because the atoms are moving all around, but it has a very benign, certain types of waxy coatings. So I don't think the idea is very long-term storage, but still storage of information for times which are relatively long to allow you to do some form of processing. You know, and eventually, really, these are also just test systems. And when Phil Hemmer is here, he'll tell us about work he's done in solids too. So hopefully, I mean, what I hope is that the fact that you can see this same basic effect as long as you set up this simple three-level type system, and it's a reasonably good approximation in a variety of systems, whether it be very cold atoms, warm atoms, or these solids, that sort of ubiquity of the phenomenon hopefully speaks to its potential practicality. Okay, so here's what we use rubidium 87, although in the first, there's a lot of imperfections in our first experiments. We did not have isotopically enriched rubidium 87. We did not have extra lasers on to get 100% state selection into the optical pumping into this state to begin with. There's a lot of things that we could and should do to improve it. But the scheme basically was to work on the D1 transition in rubidium 87. And naively to think about the atoms all starting here initially, although that it wasn't exactly true. That's right. So we had far from an optimal setup, which is, you know, if you wanted, and so that's one of the main things that I wish we could have done by now, is just to optimize a lot of things. But before you came in, I was talking about sort of the logistical realities of what we've been dealing with. Basically, the first experiments we had were bootlegged off of funding for some completely different thing, this clockwork that we're working on. And we spent about a year doing these light storage experiments, and eventually we had to go back and do what we were actually being given money for. So it's only now that we're getting back to starting to do these optimization experiments. So yes, we used a vapor cell, buffer gases. And there too, we didn't even have what is generally thought to be the best buffer gas. We weren't using neon just because it was a cell we had. We were using helium with 5-TOR. Although the whole question of buffer gases experimental is an important question. We're investigating the properties of the buffer gases or the behavior of the CPT line widths for our clock work systematically as a function of buffer gases. And there's sort of some stuff that's known, but a lot of things that aren't known. And so one of the things that will hopefully come out of that work that it could influence the sort of stored light thing is what are the optimal buffer gas to use, or perhaps even mixture, cocktail of buffer gases to use. We typically operated around 80 C. Variety of temperatures were used. You know, there's something about a 1 millimeter beam diameter, and we had storage times which were up to a few hundred microseconds. Experimental setup schematically was pretty simple.
diode laser. There was an AOM that was used to turn the control field off, essentially, by sweeping it out of the way. Pockel cell was used to blip in a little bit of the opposite helicity light, which served as the signal pulse. Of course, that was taking some from the control field. It was relatively small amounts, so it didn't really matter. We had the rubidium cell in a blown air oven inside of a solenoid magnetic shield setup that we stole from our hydrogen masers, and standard sort of optics and things to turn linear into circular and vice versa and detect the strength of the light in the different channels. So we could detect control beam or signal pulse light. And if we wanted to, and in the second experiment I'll tell you about in a second, we could bleed in a little bit of the control field into the signal pulse channel, and that was useful for doing a little for doing interference measurements. So we could change the phase of the coherence and then see that that was mapped onto the reconstituted signal pulse, and then see that there was interference between that signal pulse and the control field in the expected way. All right. Here's a little picture of the apparatus as it first sat. There's the big magnetic shields taken from our hydrogen masers. And here were some of the examples of the data that we got at the beginning. The pulses labeled 1 here are the front edge of the pulse that was not stored in the medium, which bled through before we turned the control field off. It constituted about 30% of the total pulse, or something about like that. The rest of it was contained and stored in the medium, and although it's not shown on this plot, if we turn the control field back on really early, so not even long enough to have the pulse at a time, a delay time that's less than the pulse length, we would see this released pulse be much larger. So there was some sort of rapid decay that we saw in these early experiments, followed by a much slower decay. You can see the decay from here to here to here is much less than there would be to go from a pulse that's comparable to the height here down to there in that short period of time. And that's another thing we don't understand. We haven't yet tried to study, but this kind of naively bi-exponential behavior, some rapid early decay and then a longer decay that is consistent. This longer decay is consistent with diffusion out of the beam. On the top here, like here, this is just cartoons showing you the time course of the control and signal field. These amplitudes do not reflect the actual amplitudes of the signal and control fields. It's just a cartoon schematic to show you when we turn them on and off. So if you fairly quickly after turning it off, turn it back on, we had up to 50% of the input pulse stored. But if you waited a delay time that was comparable to pulse length, it was dropped down to more like 10%. And that's actually fairly similar in terms of the fidelity or storage efficiency to what was seen in the cold atom experiments. I think not because of any underlying fundamental reason, just sort of happenstance. They got most of the pulse into the medium, but they had a lot of it outside of the transparency window, and they had a lot of absorption. And so the two experiments had different conditions, very different conditions, but both had this sort of mediocre fidelity. But good enough to sort of say the idea is qualitatively or semi-quantitatively correct. But a lot of optimization certainly needs to be done. If you take a simple model of the process and put in about with what we know to be the diffusion time constants, et cetera, and our geometry and whatnot, we would calculate something like this for the behavior, which is fairly similar to what we observed, except our pulses actually were shorter here and then had a little bit longer time constant. Yes. Yeah, right. Simulation, so it's very simple. We basically said, okay, we're not going to think too hard about this maybe bi-exponential behavior yet, where we wanted to move on to other things, and we'll put that to the side, and when we get back to having the capability to study things systematically, then we wanted to go at it systematically. Okay, so that was the extent of that first experiment. It sort of demonstrated the basic idea. And the second experiment we did was to, as I've mentioned before, was this phase coherence and control demonstration, write a phase on the stored light.
So it was added in the middle. This is the same cartoon as before, except we've added just this one step of putting on a pulsed magnetic field, uniform magnetic field, which causes just alarm or precession in the Zeeman coherence, which is in the medium. And that's under our control. We can make a pi over 2, a pi, a 87 pi, whatever we want, phase evolution of the coherence. And then we can turn the control field on. We can Raman scatter off of that coherence. And now the signal pulse which comes out, you would think, should have written on its optical phase that additional phase that you've added to the by a Larmor precession to the atomic medium. If you then could take those reconstituted signal pulse photons and interfere them with a control field, you would see either constructive or destructive interference to varying degrees depending upon what phase modulation you put onto the medium. And that's why we, as I mentioned before, intentionally bled a little bit of the control field into the signal pulse detection channel so we could see such interference. And in fact, you know, we expected that this would work. We didn't really have a realistic reason why or argument why it wouldn't, but I think it's important to go down and to show that the behavior that you think should be there in this sort of new phenomenon is really there. And so that's what we did, and this is just another way of demonstrating it. We cause a Zeeman shift and therefore a phase precession, and then we reconstitute the signal pulse here, and as you can see, there's an offset. That's the bleed through of the control light. All right, and we found what we expected, that we could see. This is zero, and then moving up to pi out of phase, and we would see destructive, and then constructive, and destructive, and constructive again. And we went up to, I can't even remember, 20 or 30 pi or something like this. We could have gone farther. And we could just, it was very nicely mapped onto what we expected, that we got the constructive and destructive interference. In between the first experiment and the second, you can see the noise is much less. We cleaned up a lot of the things that were going on in our system and made improvements. So our signal noise was much better. The fidelity really wasn't any better, so we had not made any improvements yet in that. This one here? Okay, so the green is the B field, and the blue is what you would see out in terms of the signal light. All right? So the signal pulse hasn't arrived yet. Why am I seeing a non-zero signal? The reason I'm seeing a non-zero signal is because I'm bleeding some of the control field, which is on, into this detection channel by making them not exactly map, you know, the polarizing beam splitter. You know, okay, you understand. Okay. So now here comes the signal pulse, and here's that leading edge of it, which we don't in fact store. You know, you'd like to do store it, and eventually if we optimized everything, we'd be able to take the entire pulse and map it into the medium, but as yet in our experiments we're not doing that. So there's that leading edge, and here's where the control field gets shut off. Then we turned on a magnetic field. We did it in various ways. This particular one just has it ramp up and ramp down. And of course you've got to take your integral and know what phase you put onto the medium. We make sure it's nice and uniform across the whole medium, so we're not putting a gradient on, although that'd be kind of interesting too, and we've done things like that a little bit, as well as leaving the magnetic field on while we release the pulse. But in this experiment, we just turn it off. Then we turn on the control field again, and out comes a little, depending on how long you wait, out comes a little signal, reconstituted signal pulse. And its optical phase is now, if you had not done any of that, the optical phase here would be right in phase with the control field, and you'd always get this constructive interference. But if you add a phase shift of some amount, you can make that destructive if you want. And so that's what we saw. But to be able to see destructive, i.e. to go below zero, we had to have a little bit of this bleeding in. Okay? And so, for example, when we left the magnetic field on during readout, we would see a sort of phase chirp. We'd see the constructive, destructive on the, as the pulse is being read out. Wow, 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 just as you'd expect. That's a good question, and we have not characterized that in any systematic way. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I agree. That's yet another one of those things on the long list of stuff that should be studied, and we'd like to study, but we haven't done that. I mean, we could go back to our old data, I expect, and try to see if we can draw some conclusions from the amount of distortion we saw, but we haven't even done that. So, more to do. So these results were published early this year. There's that paper. And so that's the little, that's what I'll say about the sort of published work we've done to date. And now I'll tell you, well, I've already mentioned it, but I'll start talking about the sort of laundry list of stuff that we want to do and some of these things that we're just beginning to do, et cetera. So things we'd like to do, we'd like to improve the state selection, investigate the buffer gases, use isotopically enriched 87, do a variety of things to get shorter signal pulses. You know, we think we can get some order of magnitude increase in the optical depth with some similar decoherence time so that we can store an entire pulse in a vapor cell. Is that really possible? It looks on paper like it should be. Can we really do it? The sort of canonical expression that comes out of the analysis that Michael and Misha have done is that the length of the cell that you're in divided by the length of the pulse, physical length of the pulse, has got to be less than or approximately equal to the square root of the opacity. But this opacity can be 1,000 or 10,000 or something like that in principle. So you therefore should be able to make the pulse less than the length of the cell. All right, can we do that? You're talking about the ratio out and in, yeah. So, I mean, if you want to get the whole pulse in the medium, you got to make it, once it's in the medium, be less than the size of the cell. So this now canonical, as I call it, or standard stored light theory, that maybe this is one of my good papers from the last year, and it's where Misha and Michael worked out a lot of the details. There's more to be worked out, but certainly there's many good details worked out in this paper, some of which were spicing up Michael's talk yesterday. So if you read through this and look at a variety of the things that are there, it makes a lot of sense. But we'd like to test this standard stored light theory, what I just mentioned. Can we store an entire pulse in a vapor cell? I mean, or can anyone? Maybe we're just not very good experimenters, but in principle it should be able to be done according to the theory. Can it be done? Going beyond this weak signal field approximation, which is built into the theory, they've explored a little bit the deviations that you'd expect, but experimentally it's very easy to go outside of that regime, and what do we observe? It probably will be harder, I think, to explore these non-adiabatic effects, the sort of longest time scale. So this is the time scale for turning off the control field, the sort of weakest constraint, or is it strongest? Right? Weakest constraint for that I could find in thinking about it and reading the papers for the time scale, which that's wrong, isn't it? That should be much less than. So this time scale should be much less than the length of the pulse divided by C to prevent there to be not a large control field gradient across the size of the pulse, so that you don't get much signal pulse shape distortion when you reconstitute it. But this is a time scale of 0.1 nanoseconds. So going out of this limit, you would have to make this, I guess this should be much, much greater than. So as long as you take this being much, much greater than 0.1 nanoseconds, then you're okay. But practically trying to get down to the 0.1 nanoseconds or less in terms of the shutoffs and see anything is not probably going to be possible. But I'm still thinking about that. Also, light storage is supposed to be robust under fairly large two-photon detunings. Is that really true? What happens? And that issue in particular was also addressed in a recent paper Michael wrote here. Other things we'd like to do, investigate the effect of decoherence. If you look at the initial equation set up in their PhysRev A by Michael and Misha, they have a variety of decoherence terms in the equations of motion, but they don't really investigate the effect of these different forms of decoherence very systematically. So I think that needs to be done theoretically, but also then experimentally looking at the effects of decoherence of different kinds, not just in the ground states, but the decoherence between the excited state and the ground states as well. Different types of buffer gases can affect those differently. Going beyond the lambda system, there are other levels in the problem, certainly. What is the effects there? I mentioned before using coated vacuum cells. We have the capability in our lab to make them, and we do make them. We've had line widths of a few tens of hertz wide, which is pretty good for these cells that are a couple centimeters in diameter. Are there advantages in storing pulses in those, that sort of media? And then the main thing we're working on currently is to demonstrate the use of the stored light technique as a quantum memory and pursuing other ideas as well. Yeah, the type of wax we use is known as tetracontane. It's a particular bond length of paraffin, and there are a variety of techniques that have been used over the years to deposit it. And
how do your cells compare with Alexandra cells?
I think they're pretty similar. Yeah. And Hugh Robinson in the old days made very similar cells too. So.
Hard to do. Can you just put a little wax in there and heat it up and then pull it out, or does it take a lot of technique?
It's not that hard to do if all you want to make is a simply connected geometry cell, like a cylinder or a sphere. It's not just, what's usually done there is an inductive heating technique where they put a blob on the end of a metal tip. They put it in and then inductively put energy into this filament and heat it up and let it vapor deposit under vacuum. there's, in some of our clockwork, we're doing more complicated geometries where we have two bulbs with a tube connecting it, and there we have to come up with very complicated techniques. But yeah, I think we have on my homepage, don't remember if it has everything you need to know, but there's on my group's homepage, if you go to group documents, etc., we have a PDF file available for people to download which has information on cell coating techniques. Okay, so the quantum memory idea, well, the rationale for it, as some of you may know, is that there, in classical communication, there is needs for amplification, classical repeaters in quantum communication. You can't amplify in that sort of a way, but there are ways of using quantum error correction. But the quantum error correction techniques are generally going to need to occur in some material medium where you can do information processing. And the communication of the quantum information would generally be done by light. So if on length scales which are comparable to the absorption or attenuation length for sending light through some medium, you need a repeater station. You're going to then need a mechanism for mapping the quantum information from light into matter, then do your error correction, distillation, et cetera, then reconstitute it into light, et cetera, and have each one of these stations every, you know, fraction of an absorption length as you go along. And so having a information, quantum information mapping technology may be very important. And there, in this paper here, in Nature, there's a scheme that's put forward for a quantum repeater, and it's shown that if you look at your channel length, the length of the channel divided by the absorption length for the, let's say, the light that's there, and you look at the time it would take if you just said, well, I'm not going to have a repeater, I'll just keep sending that quantum information, and eventually just it'll get through. Of course, it goes up exponentially, and it's become sort of not the smart way to do it. A repeater-based, quantum repeater-based scheme, the one they outline here, even if they have a sort of 50% sort of overall efficiency and fidelity, as you make the length long, the time it takes goes up much more slowly and not exponentially. So here very schematically, because we're very much in the middle of doing this, and there's a lot of questions we have in our own minds about how we're going to solve a lot of these problems, but very schematically is the approach that we're taking.
to just doing the kind of barest bones demonstration that this light storage technique really can be used at the single quantum level. So we're doing sort of half the job. You might naively think, okay, well, they're going to take a single photon, send it in there, do it with some control field, store it, and let it out, and they'll see they get their single photon back. But we've decided that would be too hard to start with. So instead, what we're doing is the following. So we'll take our medium. We'll just optically pump initially, of course. Then step two, we'll have an off-resonant Raman scattering that, process that has a low probability, but non-zero probability of scattering a single photon off the medium, which will be our flag photon, and therefore creating one net atom transfer and creating coherence between these levels here. This will tell us, we have to repeat it many times, most of the time it's off-resonant, we're not getting Raman scattering. Eventually, boom, we get a flag photon. It tells us you've created a single quantum atomic spin wave or coherence in this medium. Now, there's going to be about 12 orders of magnitude filtering required to be able to detect this single photon in the presence of some strong control field. But we think we can do it, combining Fabry-Perot and atomic absorption cells. So the detunings are appropriate, are necessary too, so we can have the rubidium-87, the light that we're going to use, the control field, and we're going to be doing the storage in rubidium-87, but have the control fields line up with rubidium-85 lines. And step three is just now the release half of this, let's call it standard stored light. But now what you're releasing is only a single quantum, and so a single photon comes out, and a single signal photon comes out. And we detect this single signal photon, and we correlate it with a flag photon, and we see that they're, hopefully we see that they're correlated in the way that we expect. So most of the time, there's no flag photon. Small fraction of the time, there's one flag photon, and it should be correlated with the signal photon that we release. Extremely rarely, so rare that it won't be, it almost never will occur, there could be two photons. There are analogous experiments that Mandel and others did long ago, not in this sort of a medium, but just to do single photon statistics. So it's really sort of trying to combine these Raman scattering techniques and filtering techniques with photon counting and statistics techniques. And I certainly, and Misha also, we don't have our own experience and expertise is not in all these areas. So we're learning things. We have more we need to learn. We've talked with a lot of people, and we've got people in our group that know some of this stuff too. But we're having to go through and build up some of the technology. So some of these steps are working, and some of the technologies we're in the process of developing. So I'm going to segue now into an experiment that we've done a good amount on, and there will actually be a poster on this at ICAP, if any of you are going to ICAP next week, that in Boston and Cambridge. And that's looking at the photon statistics of near-resonant Raman scattering. So the results are that we've been able to isolate a single mode of Raman light that's co-propagating mostly with an intense drive field, shifted by a few gigahertz. And we see a crossover from these Bose-Einstein to Poisson statistics as we run up the control field or drive field intensity. And we also see large intensity fluctuations on the Raman light and even on the remnant transmitted drive light, and they're strongly correlated. We don't understand this yet. We have some ideas. Maybe there's some fluctuating EIT window that's created, and we're planning to test for quantum correlations. This one here? Yeah. So it's a four-wave mixing scheme on rubidium-85 on the D1 line. The drive field can operate on both the fields here. We get on both states here. We have Stokes and anti-Stokes light that comes out that's been observed. We operate around 100 degrees C. The input drive strength or power is about 5 milliwatts typically. There's a little residual drive that comes through the medium depending upon how we set it up. Here's the schematic
We do some filtering with a Fabry Perot cavity, grating, et cetera, and we look both with a fast photodetector at the beat between the drive and the stokes or the anti-stokes, as well as doing single photon counting. Here's some images that were taken in the far field, and the Raman fields are in these side modes that kind of are mostly co-propagating, so we use a little pinhole, et cetera, to do some spatial filtering too. And the anti-stokes is, so it's mostly the stokes that we're looking at, which is just defocused, whereas the anti-stokes tends to be focused along the beam. And if we apply a large enough magnetic field, typically, it gives us a Larmor frequency of about 15 megahertz, we found that suppresses, decoheres everything, kills the atomic coherence, and the Raman scattering is suppressed, and all these intensity fluctuations and correlations between the Raman scattering and the dry field are also greatly suppressed. So if you look at the output power and the Stokes light relative to the drive input power, sort of, and we haven't really determined whether this is true, but there seems to us to be sort of a regime in which there seems almost to be a threshold regime in which the output power rapidly moves up, and that seems to correlate somewhat with the transition from, let's call it a spontaneous Raman scattering Bose-Einstein statistics regime to this Poisson regime. So if you look at the photon counting statistics that we did in these different regimes here, you see that when you're in the strong dry field limit, you have things which obey Poisson statistics quite well, and as you go down to the weak limit, it's deviating away and heading more towards the Bose-Einstein limit, although it's not fully in that limit. Again, don't fully understand this yet, but these are the sort of measurements we've been making. Excuse me? This here? Yeah, that's a plotting problem. So we've seen that this remnant transmitted dry field fluctuations or amplitude fluctuations are similar to that of the Raman fields. It gets very, very noisy. So here's the Raman in black. This is with the no magnetic field, and red is with the magnetic field on. So the Raman, the Stokes light that's coming out, if you look at the scan around and look at the frequency, you have this extremely noisy stuff. Probably some nonlinearities is making the thing go chaotic in some way we don't understand. Turn on the magnetic field, we suppress the Raman light. Here's the remnant dry light in the absence of scattering off of no atomic coherence killed by the magnetic field. But when you have no magnetic field on, you have similar fluctuations in the remnant drive light to what you have in the Stokes light. Okay, maybe you want that too. Oh boy, okay. My throat is about dead here. So I'm just going to skip past the clock things, as I said, and I'll tantalize you with a couple more things. Here's another paper. It's quite interesting. It's creating a photonic band gap in these vapor media by using I recommend this paper very well, very much, by using a standing wave. So in addition to your normal EIT setup for stored light, you have your slightly off-resonant standing wave that's set up, and this creates or at least the prediction is that it creates a refractive index in the medium that varies, and it can also create a band of frequencies for the light which cannot propagate through the medium, and hence the atomic vapor can become reflecting. And recently we've seen that. This is in the last week. We've set up the standing wave into the medium, and we've put in the light within this bandwidth, this excluded band, and we see essentially 100% reflection of the light. Now, in addition to this, what's predicted is that what if you do the following thing? So this is a more complicated scheme you use for moving atoms, which we have to use. This is the simple picture, so I'm just going to be pointing at that one for stationary atoms. The idea that's also in this paper that Axel Andre and Misha wrote is that if you start by doing a normal stored light thing, you let the pulse in, stop it, store it,
then turn on and release the pulse at the same time you put on this off-resonant standing wave. Now what are the solutions? The solutions are that the pulse is reconstituted, but it's in this excluded regime. So you now have light which is stuck in the medium and in fact rattles around within the medium, oscillating between light going in one direction with real electric fields, back into the atomic coherence as it scatters off this refractive, this modulated refractive index in the medium, reconstituted as light going back in the other direction with real electric fields, scatters off the medium, turns into atomic coherence, then goes in the other direction. So you cycle between light going in, back and forth between the coherence, the atomic coherence, and the light in the two directions. And it's plotted here so that you have a uniform averaged over the atomic, the optical wavelength, intensity of the electric field, which is uniform, but it has components in both moving in one direction and moving in the other direction, as well as these polariton. So these are the polariton solutions, and these are the components of the electric field, which are there as well. And we haven't experimentally gotten to that point yet, but it's an interesting thing. So we have to come up with some new poetic term. Maybe we call it juggling light, because now it's going back and forth. It's stuck in the medium that's juggling back and forth between moving this way and this way. And depending upon where you look at it in the cycle, it either does or does not have electric field components to it. Okay. Yeah. Standing, but it's sort of back and forth. That's why I was just thinking juggling. Well, I don't know. So, that's a preprint. Came out in May. So there's your quant fizz. Came out in May. So, but the first step, just to turn on the standing wave and to see reflection, it does look like it's working. Again, please, big chunks of rock salt with everything I'm saying on this new stuff, because we have not completed everything and we're not sure about the results. Well, a couple more papers I think are interesting. We have not yet set up to do these experiments, but we'd like to. Things that are discussed in this paper here and in here for creating spin squeeze and then mapping it back onto light, squeezed light. These are some interesting schemes. But I won't say anything about that other than that they're interesting and we hope to do it. And there's also some sort of detail and complicated things that have been looked at by Serac and Zoller and Dwan in this paper, which are probably also interesting and worth doing experimentally. So I'll conclude. I've told you a little bit about, you know, what we're doing in this relatively new collaboration at Harvard. Talked a little bit about the work, published work we've done to date, our planned experiments. We'd like to sort of do a lot of nuts and bolts optimization and testing of the canonical theory. Our outline of our plan to demonstrate single quantum storage, which we're about sort of halfway through in terms of experimental things we need to do. Hopefully it'll work. Some recent measurements that are still ongoing and looking at the statistics of Raman light, and some recent theory papers and very recent results in terms of looking at this photonic band gap stuff. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Particularly the second one, I think, asks the question.
That guy?
Yeah, I'm surprised that you go from thermal to Poissonian so fast. If you look at a laser,
yeah,
you go through threshold, there's a long region, that is to say.
I'm going to sit down because I'm not feeling well.
CO2 lasers are Poissonian, but helium neon lasers are definitely not. They're, according to this distribution that we got, Lam and I, 4 or 5 times broader than Poissonian. So you're jumping from Bose from thermal to Poisson. Maybe it's because you have a convolution somewhere. There's extra noise mixed in. Or maybe you're just way above threshold.
Yeah. I
totally disagree. I'm not about to do it. But I think it's not a special system. I think there's no defect.
It's not in a cavity, no.
Yeah, but there could be a cavity in the sense of distributing feedback cavity, right? That we were just talking about. A Raman distributing feedback kind of thing, why not?
I think in this case you only have four. You would like to have only four for the most threshold. Is any good up on the back scattering?
We've not tried to measure any backscattering light. I'm not sure whether there is or not.
It's normally feedback, the non-linearity, that takes you from thermal to laser statistics, okay? And so somehow you expect that there's some non-linearity in here that's doing the...
I don't know, but some of the things we've thought about is that you build up, it's a sort of a temporal thing, you build up as you, how do I say this right, as you build up a coherence that's initially due to spontaneous Raman scattering, then the other new photons that come in are going to be more stimulated Raman scattering. And
oh, maybe that's the key. If it's strictly spontaneous, then it's always Poisson. Ah, now, okay. Now I think I see. Yes. If it's only spontaneous, then every photon is uncorrelated
right
to the other. And that's the opposite of thermal. So then it would be Poisson for sure. And no threshold.
Okay. And also, why is there a kink there? I mean, this kink is very artificial.
Well,
CW experiment.
Yeah, don't worry about the kink. I mean, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 data points. And Casper, who made this graph, for some reason, just drew lines between them. I don't think we're trying to imply that it's leaping off the curve right there, necessarily. But
I think there's no sign of
The analysis of that stuff was done by Casper, and I'd have to ask him what he tried to fit or didn't fit it to. It looks like that graph he made up there, he had it. He was just connecting the dots. But I don't know what they tried to fit it to or didn't try to fit it to.
But don't you agree? Now I say it's obvious why it's still something, right? Going from not being able to understand to now it's obvious. If it's spontaneous, which I think it is now when you tell the story, then you would expect for something.
Having a high power and a low power, that seems bad.
Yeah, but it's wrong.
Even more spontaneous at low power than it is at high power.
But if you need some power to get the thing going, it's just that you need that amount of power in order to see a signal.
Well, it's a conservation law. You used to understand, and now you used to not understand, now you do, and I flip the other way.
Okay, amplify something. I mean, if you want to reduce the power of something, then amplify something to go for the point that you power those, let's say, crosses your head. But then, this is still over into something that's important on the pressure, amplify something.
And you expect to be super far sound.
I'm going to see a question of integration time. If your integration time is too long, you'll make any distribution look like something. So if being a CW experiment, unless you're really integrating just over the coherence time, the offset light, I think you'll end up lowering your surface area.
Let me see if I can remember. They did this for a variety of... I don't remember. They did it for a variety of delay times and a variety of integration times. But I don't remember exactly what the numbers are. I can find out. This was done in the spring, late spring, and then we shelved it, and now we have an internal debate, so I'd like your... It's an avalanche photodiode, yeah.
It's a multi-count step. You're plus, one of plus, two lines. Then you're APD will not be found for everything.
Yeah, that's right. So...
In other words, you're separating your APD.
Right.
That's...
I think that was checked for by intentionally, you know, putting some filters and things in there. But I'm not sure about that. It was done a few months ago. Yeah, I mean, well, you know, the debate we have in our group or our collaboration is, let's say the experimenters, when we run into something like this and we're just finding some stuff and we don't understand it, we're more likely just to, well, let's make some measurements and write a paper and see what people say. And the theorists don't want us to do that till they understand it so they can say what it is. But then they're busy doing other things, and the data sits around for 2 months. Well, I don't know is that single photon pulses in a controlled way?
Yeah, because you release them what you want. Well,
okay, but you still have to wait until the flag photon tells you that you've got the thing there, so. Ah, yeah, okay. So you're saying you're talking about crafting the coherent spatial distribution of coherence.
Yeah, one that coincides with spatial coherence example, and then releasing false with a complicated control shape.
Right. Yeah, there may be a lot of ideas like that have some validity that. Should be.
Well, I'm not skeptical about 10 minus 12 children. It's the fact that your frequency is in the bottom line.
talking about 120 BP filtering. And that's incredible.
Well, there's you can buy, you can, now it's not exactly what we want to do, but you can get up to 11 orders of magnitude commercially available with certain forms of Fabry-Perot cavities for similar 6 or 7 gigahertz splittings. We're not going, what's available is not exactly what we want, so we're going to be making our own setup, plus using atomic filter cells, as I said, which can have, can give you many orders of magnitude too, if you have things tuned properly. So we'll see, you know, there's a lot of issues of background light and background scatter, and it may not work, we'll have to see.
I think this is probably the hard part to see, but on the other hand, you get really detailed, because you have the light, the consumer photon light source actually on demand. So if you can first, measure the first,
I was going to say regarding your idea that there's other things we've also thought about, some based upon my experience with NMR, which is that once you have a coherence in the atomic medium, there's a variety of NMR techniques using pulse field gradients, et cetera, which lets you manipulate the coherence grating, let's say, in ways which then you could, so you could craft it in a variety of ways and then read out the pulse. Yeah. Hologram? I'm not going to even try to answer because I know so little about holograms that I...
Could I try to answer that?
Sure.
With a hologram, you're doing essentially scattering off of a population gradient when you get the sensitivity you expect. With a phase, quantum phase gradient, you get the essentially 100% transfer of light from one to the other. And you know these things, so I'm wondering why it is that this argument doesn't convince you. I can only hear one at a time, right? So you're asking for him to talk louder? Yeah, well, you do.
But if I take two coherent things, right, and I can make one of them, the sensitivity
would
be equal.
It's what?
The sensitivity would be equal.
No, because when I write a hologram, I only have some efficiency, right? And it's certainly not 100%. But with these phase gradients, quantum phase gradients, it is the same thing, 100%. So I'm now trying to get on the same...
I think the difference is that in a hologram, you really saw the properties of the source, not of the light path. Because if you can make a hologram with a single photon light path, then yes, you have precisely the same thing. But what you have in mind is really a stationary or long extended light source which writes a hologram, which encrypts the information of the source, and it's essentially the W source of the hologram. It's a different story. Here you can score a single path, single photon. And if you can do this as a hologram, then in principle you're right, and it's the same thing.
You agree with that?
Well,
there is a field of the holographic famous bird, where I think it's really nice to and even the next one, it's possibly
could I make his argument the way he's making it? He says, look, a hologram is nothing but a mirror. A mirror is 100%. In comes a photon, out goes a photon. Don't try to tell me you're going to do better than that.
But that's even coherent.
That's what you're saying. But Michael's point is that you can't make the mirror with 100% efficiency. You can't make the hologram with 100% efficiency, but you can make these gratings with very high efficiency. Is that not the right way to say it?
So you all, as I said at the beginning, my own experience is not in this field. So I, one of the reasons I like coming here is to learn from you. And
make your 5 minutes break, and then continue with.
So let me know when you figure it out, because I'd like to know.